sitting out on the veranda of the house we have taken down a Sorrento this year. It is not the one we had the previous few seasons, because that went before we arranged to let the owner know that we wanted it. And the one we're in now is right on the Point Nepean Road, just about a few hundred yards or so before you turn up into the main Sorrento Road. It's been a very cold Christmas season, Christmas and New Year season, the coldest that I think I can remember for a great many years. Now, the main object of this talk is to follow the suggestion you made recently about your two grandfathers placing on record, while they're still on the land, in the land of the living, a few remarks or deal with the remembrances and memorabilia that goes back as far as their early memory will take them, and runs through important incidents that happened during the during lifetime. I have very much in mind your little memorandum or stricture, not trivia. Now, the question arises, you know the old saying, what is one man's meat, etc.? Well, what is trivia? To one person, this may be, to another person, that may be. So, while I will probably include items that to you may seem to be very trivial, on the other hand, they may stand out in my memory as something that of some special importance. Now, with that peroration for a start, I'll go back to some of my earliest recollections. I remember standing at the corner of Collins Street and Elizabeth Street, where the Colonial Mutual building is now, in the very early years of this century, and being held by the hand by my nurse by the name of Sarah, who looked after myself and my young sister Irene, and with a great many other people lined up on the sidewalk, seeing a motor car go past, which was quite an event. I can't remember the ancient story of the car being preceded by a chap with a red flag or lantern or something, which I've read about, but this must have been a little later than that period, but it was still an event to see a car driving down the centre of the city of Melbourne. My earliest recollections, of course, are of the home in which I was born. The house was called Nestlewood, and it was situated 187 George Street, East Melbourne. My father built it somewhere around the early 1880s, well before I was born, when the family's first two or three children had arrived. I have been to see it several times over the last 30 to 40 years, and it had a stained glass window, like a church window, of which the family were very proud, the origin of which I don't know. And on a couple of occasions, the occupier or owner has invited me in when I've told my little story and shown me around and let me have a look at what seemed the huge backyard, which in retrospect seemed tremendously huge, but in my latter days looked just the reverse. And only very few years ago the house was pulled down, and a modern block of flats is now erected in its place. I have a fairly clear recollection of the death of Queen Victoria. She died, of course, in 1900, and I can remember my nurse, Sarah, was a Tasmanian girl, although, of course, in those days, my young age, she seemed quite an elderly sort of person to me. I remember her weeping copious tears when the news came through. And I've seen people standing in the streets crying at the news of Queen Victoria's death. Of course, one must remember that nearly everybody living at the date of her death had known no other queen or sovereign other than Queen Victoria, who, of course, reigned, as you know, for 63 years. Another incident that stands out very clearly in my mind in the early days was the relief of Mafeking. Mafeking was a town in South Africa which was besieged by the Boers during the Boer War of 1999 to 1901, and the town was in a very bad way. The soldiers and the population were practically starving, and the Boers had a complete circle of the town, and it looked like a terrific tragedy. And in spite of the efforts of the British Army under Sir Redvers Bullers, who was the commander-in-chief, as I well remember his name, they couldn't breach the encirclement of the town. And then one day the news arrived that Mafeking had been relieved. The whole town went mad, and I remember my uncle Harry Marks, who's been dead a great many years now, my father's brother, or one of my father's brothers, rushing up to our house. He was terribly merry. He'd had quite a few under his belt, grabbing hold of Mother, lifting her up. She was quite a small person, by the way, giving her a good smacking kiss and saying, "Hooray, Mafeking has been relieved," and so on. There was great excitement all around, and the whole incident lives fairly freely in my memory, because it must have made quite a great impression. Incident that I well remember, of course, considerably later on, that is the first aeroplane flight in Melbourne. It was by a Frenchman who had a small plane, I've forgotten what sort now, and the exhibition was to be given at the Melbourne Cricket Ground. We all turned up there, and my father and all my brothers were members for many years, when the boys were quite young, and a huge crowd attended to see this memorable event. The Frenchman got into his plane and started off and revved up the engines, and then amidst a great whirl of excitement, the plane rose off the ground and gradually gained a little height, and then it started to move away, but it didn't gain quite enough height to clear the cricket scoring board, which it hit, fell back on its side, and that was the end of the flight. And that one, the pilot wasn't hurt, but I can very clearly recollect that incident, although I couldn't possibly place the year. The incident itself, however, I think shows that it must have been somewhere in the first decade of this century. Your father has suggested that I make some reference to the early known facts about an arrival of our family here in Australia. This, of course, could not possibly be from my own knowledge or remembrance or observations in any way, but perhaps it wouldn't be amiss to just mention a few brief facts. My grandfather, with a number of his children arrived in Melbourne by a sailing vessel whose name I have known but have forgotten in, I think, 1851. My father was born just prior to leaving Liverpool, and I have always understood that he was taught to walk on the deck of the vessel, the voyage taking, of course, quite a good many months. My father was one of a very large family. I believe there was somewhere something like 10 or 12 children. The eldest ones I only know by repute, or rather by hearsay, never having met them. And about three quarters of the family were born in Liverpool, and the balance were born about four or five of them after arrival in Australia. You will have seen that family tree that I partly prepared, and which was greatly added to by the visit of Mr. Bill Jessup from USA about a year ago, when he showed us his book of family trees. And there was one of our family dating back to the original immigration of the earliest forebear we can trace from Poland to London somewhere in the late 16th century. I had a number of photostats made of this, and subsequent to distributing them to the various members of the family, they've been added to quite a good deal by various ones who've added on their own families and their own offspring and so on. One of the most notable ones being Walter Bridgeland, who just concluded his third term as Lord Mayor of Adelaide, following the footsteps of his grandfather, Sir Lewis Cohen, my uncle by marriage, he having married one of my father's sisters, and who was noted for being seven consecutive times the Mayor of Adelaide, and finally finally being in office when, by his efforts, Adelaide was made into a Lord Mayoralty rather than a Mayoralty. Of course, the outstanding events during my lifetime have been the two great world wars. In World War One, when World War One broke out, I, after various attempts at different jobs, positions, and little starts and goes on my own account, was in partnership with my brother Lionel, known as Nello, and we had just obtained the franchise for the Kaiser merchandise manufactured in America for the Commonwealth of Australia. We'd only been going about a year, or maybe a little more, when war broke out, and in September of August, September of 1914, and my brother decided that one of us should go, and he enlisted and left me to carry on. He, however, after a very interesting few months of training in Egypt and the canal and sending us various letters and photographs, some of which are in my keeping now, was killed in the landing on May the 5th, 1915, in the landing at Gallipoli. We have never been able to find any definite record or any close friends in the army who actually could give us a first-hand account of how he came to be killed. But we did weeks later receive a letter dictated by General Monash himself, which gave a brief account of the particular action in which he met his death. Speaking of General Monash, I always remember when Lloyd George made the important pronouncement in the House of Commons that had the war lasted a little longer, there was one general in the Allied armies who had proved so outstanding that he probably would have replaced General Foch of the French army as the General Lisbo of the whole of the Allied armies. And he mentioned by name General John Monash. Robert, your father has suggested that I include a brief outline of the history of Marx and Solvig, or L&E Marx and Solvig as it originally was when it was first formed. Shortly after its formation, it was changed from a partnership into a proprietary company known as L&E Marx Proprietary Limited, and under this name traded until 1920. In July of 1920, I took Jules Solvig in as a shareholder and partner and director with a minority holding in the company, whose name was changed to L&E Marx and Solvig Proprietary Limited. And it traded this way until 1930-31. A year or two ago, Cecil Schilling, who joined me in Brisbane as a lad in 1922, and who eventually, shortly after my retirement in 1954, was appointed into my seat as Managing Director of Kaiser Proprietary Limited Australia, asked me to write a short, brief resume of the history of Marx and Solvig and the Kaiser business in Australia. I remember doing this in a very brief, summing up of the of my memory. But I completely lost track of the folio which had been typed, and I rang him up only a few days ago to ask him if he could had a copy and could let me have it. And he said, "No, you said you would do that, and you told me you were going to do it, but to my knowledge, you never did it, and I never received a copy." I was very mystified by this because I perfectly clearly remember dictating it and it being typed. So I started looking through my old files in the office, and I came across a couple of copies of this very document I was looking for only 4 or 5 days ago. We are down here at Sorrento for another about another 10 or 12 days. Your father's going up to town tomorrow, and I've asked him to bring it bring it back here to Sorrento to me. And just while I'm lazing here in the beach or on the up on the veranda, I'll take the opportunity of reading it onto this record, so that there will be a permanent record of what I've been able to transcribe to paper. Although, as I say, it is quite a superficial account, and certainly did, beyond giving the main outlines, did not go in any detail into the 30, 40 years of my active career in connection with Kayser. My original contact with Kayser started in 1913 and finished in 1954. So there was really 41 years of active participation in the establishment of a completely unknown name, Kayser, in Australia, to one of the best known products of its kind when I retired in June of 54. I think the best thing I can do is to just read it onto this tape when your father brings it back here probably tomorrow. Just a haphazard item of memory. I can well remember when Nanny and I were in San Francisco in 1952. It was the year of the presidential election. And, of course, television was very new to us. I mean, it hadn't arrived in Australia until quite some years later. And we were in our room in the hotel, quite interested in watching it when a program came on in which Eisenhower and his adversary for the Democratic nomination, who I think was Wilkie, I'm not quite sure who it was at the time now, whether I'm right there. Anyway, the two of them met and had a discussion, and each gave their views and, in other words, made a plea to the nation for support for the coming presidential election. Both tremendously impressed by both men. I remember when the session ended, we each turned to each other and said, "Well, it doesn't really matter which one gets elected; they're both A1 top markers." Your father has just put a heading here suggesting that I give a few brief remarks about the family of my two wives during my lifetime. The first one, of course, being the Goldring family. Magnus Goldring emigrated to Australia from Birmingham, England, where he had been in the wholesale jewellery and manufacturing trade in some way or other, which I'm not very clear about, and brought out a number of brought out the representation of a number of British Midland manufacturers whose products he started selling in Australia. He was a very short stature man, probably not very much over 5 feet. He was quite a strong personality and was very much liked by the jewellery trade in Sydney. He married a Sydney girl, Eva Myers, and had three boys and one daughter. The three boys all volunteered en masse at the start of the 1914-18 war, and two of them got commissions in the army, Harold and Eric, while Leslie ended up as a staff sergeant major. They were all more or less wounded during the course of the campaign, and the eldest one, Harold, was actually left on the battlefield for dead, but subsequently someone noticed a slight sign of movement, and he was picked up, and although he had a bullet through the windpipe, he managed to recover. And eventually lived to a good 70 years. The youngest of all, the girl, Marjorie, and I were married in Sydney in 1917. and your father Leslie and your sister Jane were the issue of the marriage. We'd only been married 5 years when Marjorie died giving birth to Jane. After that, I took the two children and joined forces with my brother Mark and his wife Violet and their three children, and we took a big house together down in Brighton, where I lived for several years, and eventually we moved to another large house in Toorak Road, South Yarra, where we lived for another year or so, and then in December of 1925, I married Nancy Heyman. The house in Toorak Road was not only quite a large old-fashioned mansion, but had a very large ballroom attached to the side, and it was one of the social dances that I gave occasionally in this ballroom that I met Nan when she was over from New Zealand on a visit to her aunts and cousins, the Pikes and the Lawrences in Melbourne. Her people were originally one of the earliest pioneers into the business world in New Zealand. Two brothers, Latchman and Henry Heyman, came to New Zealand in the very early years of the colony's existence. I have no record of the actual dates. And they opened a wholesale hardware, fancy goods, tobacco and various other departments in a large trading concern called P. Heyman and Company Limited. Their headquarters was Dunedin, New Zealand, which is a small town, the very south tip of New Zealand, but they had large warehouses in Christchurch, Wellington, Auckland, and other parts of New Zealand. And Nan's father, Joe Heyman, or Joseph Heyman, evidently left the family menage in England, took his patrimony with him, and went to make his way in some of the islands of the Pacific. The venture did not work out financially satisfactorily, and he subsequently came back to New Zealand and joined the company, although he did not. He had forfeited his shareholding inherited from his father, but he worked for the company for a good many years thereafter and ended up as the general manager of their main warehouse in Auckland, New Zealand. When the Great World Depression of 1931-32 hit, the business more or less closed and crumbled to a very tiny magnitude in New Zealand, and Joe Heyman and his wife left there and came across to live in Melbourne. Son Philip followed them very shortly afterwards. Then and I had been married about 7 years, 7 or 8 years when this happened, and they started a small business. Joe Heyman with Philip started a small business in Melbourne, which lasted for a year or two, and then I offered Phil an opening that had become available in the Kayser organization. He accepted it, and within a very, very short time, soon proved that he had unusual business capacity and ability, not only in trading, but in his remarkable personality and the ease with which he made friends and strong personal ties with the customers of the company, and also showed a marked affinity for particular section in which I had to which I had allocated him, and made of it in a very short period a tremendously successful section. I feel I must recount here statement made to me by a man called George Purdy of McWhirter's of Brisbane. Now, McWhirter's are a very, very old, established departmental store in Brisbane, which was bought out some 15 years or more ago by Myers of Melbourne. Before they were... Well, while the firm traded as McWhirter's and was owned by the McWhirter family, this George Purdy, who joined the company apparently as quite a young man, had been elevated at various degrees until he became placed in charge of their very large underwear department. The manager of this section, he and Phil, had quite a lot to do in common did a great deal of business together. After Myers Melbourne bought McWhirter's, George Purdy gradually increased his status with the company, and after some years was appointed managing director. After the then managing director, Mr. Harold Fielding, who had been with the company for many years, reached the retiring age. Some 3 or 4 years later, I was walking through the ground floor of Myers Melbourne, and I ran into Mr. George Purdy, who was down on a visit from Queensland. We both stopped, and I said, "Oh, hello, George, it's nice to see you." And he said, I'm glad to see you, Ernest. And we had a little bit of a chat, and then Phil Hayman's name came up. And without any query or any question on my part, he came out with a statement, "Look here, Ernest, Phil Hayman was the outstanding man that the underwear industry in Australia has ever known or ever will know." Phil, of course, had been dead some years when this happened, and I felt it was a wonderful tribute coming spontaneously as it did from this man. And I've always remembered it, and I feel that I'm glad to have an opportunity of just placing that little incident down on record. I hope your grandfather will do something similar to this, because I had a very interesting talk to him on Christmas Day down at your mother and father's house at Warrender Avenue after a midday meal. He and I sat out on the back lawn for an hour or so, and I was asking him about the background of his family and what academics there were among the his close relations, and he gave me a pretty good account of some of the people such over the family, and a good sketch, really, of his father, who started, apparently, this Deacon Canning Company. He also told me there was some academic figures on your grandmother's side as well. Although mostly he dealt with the deacon side, one of whom, if I remember correctly, was Archbishop of some part of the some diocese in England. His mind, of course, is very clear, and I feel that if he were to follow this example and put down on tape for record some of the things he told me and a good many others that he didn't, it would be a record well worth having. Of course, the whole idea of this talk and the suggestion that that your grandfather do the same emanated in the first place from you. I think it was a very fine thought, really, because a very simple matter to sit out here as I'm doing now with the sun shining down and a lovely cool breeze coming straight off the sea and a nice little cozy veranda on the Point of Pean Road, just lazing back in an easy chair and dictating this record for what it's worth. And for those who may be find some interest in listening to it. Incidentally, I've just read an account in the Australian of how that church that your grandfather takes a great interest in up in Carlton, where they have the multilingual earphones, is being used to teach new arrivals in Australia from various countries who have no knowledge of English, being used by letting them use the various earphones and being tutored by people of their own coming from their own country with their own language and giving them lessons in English. Found this quite interesting. Well, Robert, I think the session will have to conclude now. I'm trying to make up my mind whether I go and have a game of bowls this afternoon. I haven't played since my little misadventure, which I wrote you about. And if I do, I'll have to go and have a quick snack and be ready to go with your father, who's going to have a game this afternoon. As I say, when he brings that script that I dictated down back, I'll add it to this, for what it's worth, I'll add it to this little chat. Cheerio, old chap.
Hello, Robert. This is the 12th of December. We are still at Sorrento, and we have another week or so to go here. Your father went up to town today and brought back a letter of yours dated the 6th of December, which is the first and only letter that's so far been received from England. It was quite interesting hearing all you crammed into your first 6 days or so in England and the various people that you met. Jane and your father have just gone off for a few holes of golf, and I thought I'd carry on with the short review of the Kayser Company, and which, of course, I figure throughout, along the lines of my earlier talk on this tape to you of some days ago. I propose, therefore, just to read this comparatively short statement that I dictated several years ago, and which actually I had lost sight of until just a few days ago. I know that it covers some of the same ground that I covered in my talk to you, recent talk to you on this same tape, but I'm afraid there's no way of unduplicating that. Yeah, well, the statement that I prepared at the request of Cecil Schilling, by the way, who, as you probably know, took my seat eventually as managing director of the company for several years until he himself subsequently retired, is as follows. Julius Kayser, a young immigrant from Europe, arrived in the USA somewhere in the 1880s. He started by making silk gloves and somewhere along the line developed a process which he patented for putting double finger tips at the top of each finger of the glove. He created a slogan, "The tips outwear the gloves," and on this foundation built up a very large business which later developed into hosiery and then into underwear, all with the basic fundamental background of pure silk. The first connection with Australia was made in 1912. when Lionel Marx and Ernest Marx joined forces and traded under the name of Ellen E. Marx and started to develop the Kayser franchise for Australia. The franchise gave them the sole right to import Kayser goods into Australia, which they purchased, imported, and distributed as wholesale merchants to the retail trade. Lionel Marx was killed in the Gallipoli landing in 1915. Ernest Marx carried on the business under the above title until 1920, when the firm was made into a proprietary company and Jules Solwick was taken in as a shareholder and director, and the name of the firm was changed to Ellen E. Marx and Solwick Proprietary Limited. The company continued to import in ever-increasing quantities hosiery, underwear and gloves, chiefly of the Kayser brand, from the USA, while substantial quantities of cotton fabric gloves also were imported from the Kayser factory in Chemnitz, Germany. The type of hosiery imported in the early post-war years was of the cut and sewed type, which was known as Italian silk. I refer, of course, to the First World War. These stockings were cut from heavyweight, flat, knitted, pure silk fabric, cut and trimmed to shape and then sewn up. Knitted hosiery of pure silk appeared in the early 1920s and was the ingrain of what was known as the ingrain type. That is to say, they were knitted on full-fashioned machines from yarns that had been previously dyed. This process was followed shortly afterwards with what was then called the dip-dye process, by which the stockings were knitted in what was called the grey and subsequently dyed and finished afterwards. Prior to about 1913, silk stockings were an almost unattainable and highly treasured article by most women, and most certainly Australian women. The type of stockings mostly worn were knitted from fine cotton, or as it was termed, lisle yarns, and were retailed in Australian shops for ninepence, 11pence, 1 shilling and sixpence, and the best types for 1 shilling and 11pence a pair. They were dyed black or bleached white, and only occasionally a few were offered in tan or grey. Our firm was one of the very first two firms to import silk stockings into Australia. The invention of rayon yarns then, at that time, and for some years thereafter, known only in those days as artificial silk yarn, came at about this time, and this enabled the stockings to be sold at a popular price, thus initiating thus imitating real silk and giving a great impetus to the demand. Pure silk, however, remained the outstanding desideratum for women everywhere. About 1923, the New Zealand market was opened up by Marx and Solwick Proprietary Limited, and an office was started in Wellington, the capital. Shortly afterwards, another office was opened in Auckland, which became the head office for the branch in Dunedin. Lionel Clabin was released from the Australian organisation and had charge of the New Zealand branch, which imported its supplies direct from North America under the direction of the Melbourne Company. I say North America because Kayser also had a very large factory at a small town called Sherbrooke, just outside of Montreal, Canada. During the 1920s, the business grew in both Australia and New Zealand to very substantial proportions. Permanent branch offices and distributing centres were opened in Perth, Brisbane, Adelaide and Hobart, as well as the distributing centre in Sydney, which was established in the early days of the company's activities. During the whole of this period, the company was undoubtedly by far the leading importer and distributor of silk hosiery in the Commonwealth of New Zealand. And the same applied to fabric gloves, that is, gloves made of other than leather. In 1926, the federal government placed practically prohibitive duties on the importation of silk and cotton undergarments from abroad. This section of the company's activities had to be abolished, although the overall volume continued to expand. In November 1929, the federal government placed prohibitive duties on the importation of women's hosiery, and the Australian company persuaded the parent company in New York to ship plant and machinery to build a factory for the manufacture of stockings in Australia. Land was purchased in Richmond, Victoria. Building was commenced in the early part of 1930. The Australian Knitting Mills, known popularly as the AKM, became partners and took up a minor shareholding in the company, which was known as Julius Kayser Australia Proprietary Limited. The first chairman of this new company, which was registered as Julius Kayser Australia Proprietary Limited, was the late Mr. F. F. Robinson of AKM and Yarra Falls Limited, two of the then largest textile companies in Australia, who, however, was succeeded a little later when the American company purchased the minority holding of the AKM and Yarra Falls Group, and Mr. H.D. Giddy was appointed chairman, and he guided the company from its early years to its top place in its special field in the Australian economy. The late Mr. Arthur Phillips, a very well-known lawyer of Melbourne, who was succeeded by Mr. Jim Forrest, now Sir James Forrest, and also the late Mr. Percy Danby, were members of the board of the company from its earlier formative years. The first stockings came off the machines in the early part of 1931 and in 1932, and the first standard stockings to be advertised throughout Australia under the slogan of Lucky Ladies of 1932 was distributed by the new Australian company in the middle of that year. The stocking was of an 8-thread silk with a cotton top of 250s mercerized cotton and was retailed at 4 and 11 per pair, giving the retailer a full profit.